Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and in our appeal to heaven, we want to make sure that you learn, pray, and act. Got to convince you to actually do something, because bottom line, it's just not going to happen without people engaging, period. It is just going to keep getting worse. And even though we perceive it as, wow, that's much better, I can't deny that things are getting more tolerable, but bottom line, we're still moving towards those welcoming, open arms and the loving arms of the globalists who hate America and who hate individual liberty and individual sovereignty. So with that, let me actually welcome Tammy back. Welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And so as I look at the campaign, your campaign begins today, as well as we kind of look at, you know, the issues of holding people accountable, because that's the whole point of your campaign. It would be so much nicer if the Department of Justice and or at every level, from the county, state, and federal level, we actually had, I will just call it an enforcement entity that would just come in and just remove people that fast for violating their oath of office. So with that, we're going to be picking back up today where we kind of, you know, jumped into, and we didn't get to it, though. We're in reading Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. This is where they start revisiting their discussion and debate over property. And so this is, folks, just for you, so you can read along with us. This is on Tuesday, July 26, 1787. And we're actually picking up with Mr. Mason. It's his second discourse that he speaks for the day. And this is where we have it kind of labeled as property. It's blue highlighted. And so are you kind of ready to take it from there?
Yep.
Okay. So go ahead. Let's pick it up with property.
All right. Mr. Mason moved that the Committee of Detail be instructed to receive a clause requiring certain qualifications of landed property and citizenship of the United States and members of the legislature, and disqualifying persons having unsettled accounts with or being indebted to the U.S. from being members of the national legislature. He observed that persons of the latter descriptions had frequently gotten into the state legislatures in order to promote laws that might shelter their delinquencies, and that this evil had crept into Congress if report was to be regarded.
Okay, so what he's basically talking about is he's talking about how when people owe money, they, in other words, they have an account like taxes or what have you, that they shouldn't be allowed to get into public office, because then they use their position to protect themselves, because it's applying the protection for everybody else in office. They go, well, you know what? I think I wouldn't mind having delinquent accounts and not having to pay anybody. I think I'd like to not have to get in trouble because I didn't pay my taxes, but we'll hold everybody else accountable. This is the paradigm of corruption. And he's just pointing out that even back then they had these problems. Interesting. Okay, so Mr. Pinckney seconded the motion. Now Mr. Governor Morris of Pennsylvania piped in. Go ahead.
So Mr. Governor Morris, if qualifications are proper, he would prefer them in the electors rather than the elected. As to debtors of the U.S., they are but few. as to persons having unsettled accounts. He believed them to be pretty many. He thought, however, that such a discrimination would be both odious and useless, and in many instances unjust and cruel. The delay of settlement had been more the fault of the public than of the individuals. What will be done with those patriotic citizens who have lent money or services or property to their country without having been yet able to obtain a liquidation of their claims? Are they to be excluded? And then Mr.
Go ahead,
Gorm,
Mr. Gorm, yep, of Massachusetts.
Mr. Gorm was leaving to the legislature the providing against such abuses as had been mentioned. Colonel Mason mentioned the parliamentary qualifications adopted in the reign of Queen Anne, which he had met with universal approbation. Mr. Madison had witnessed the zeal of men having accounts with the public get into the legislatures for sinister purposes. He thought, however, that if any precaution were to be taken for excluding them, the one proposed by Colonel Mason ought to be new modeled. It might be well to limit the exclusion of persons who had recorded money from the public and had not accounted for it.
I think that's received money from the public and
received,
had not accounted.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Received money from the public and had not accounted for it.
Yeah, okay. So Mr. Governor Morris then pipes in again because he was the one that kind of said, hey, you know, this is maybe more of a problem than it is, you know, doing this accountability may be more of a problem than what we, you know, would think, because some of these people were pretty patriotic and it wasn't their fault and so forth. So Mr. Morris then pipes in and says,
Mr. Morris, it was precept of great antiquity as well as high authority that we should not be righteous over much. He thought we ought to be equally on our guard against being wise over much. The proposed regulation would enable the government to exclude particular persons from office as long as they please. He mentioned the case of the commander-in-chief presenting his account for Secret Services, which he said was so moderate that everyone was astonished at it, and so simple that no doubt could arise on it. Yet had the auditor been disposed to delay the settlement, how easily might he have affected it, and how cruel would it be in such a case to keep a distinguished and meritorious citizen under a temporary disability and disenfranchisement. He mentioned this case merely to illustrate the objectionable nature of the proposition. He was opposed to such minutious regulations in a constitution. The parliamentary qualifications quoted by Colonel Mason have been disregarded in practice and was but a scheme of the landed against the moneyed interest.
Okay. Okay, so Mr. Pinckney and General Pinckney, apparently both of them in unison, moved to insert by way of amendment the words "do judiciary and executive" so as to extend the qualifications to those departments, which was agreed to without any contest. And then Mr. Gary basically went ahead and pitched into this idea. Go ahead.
Mr. Gary thought the inconveniency of excluding a few worthy individuals who might be public debtors or have unsettled accounts ought not to be put in the scale against the public advantages of the regulation, and that the motion did not go far enough.
Ah, okay. So let's put some more pepper on it, all right? So Mr. King of Massachusetts observed that there might be great danger in requiring landed property as a qualification, since it would exclude the moneyed interest, whose aids may be essential in particular emergencies to the public safety. So what are they talking about? Do you understand this requiring landed property as a qualification?
Not really. I don't know what landed property means.
Okay, landed property means that you own the land. And,
okay, gotcha.
You know, instead of excluding those who had basically a loan or they're in the process of paying for their land,
gotcha,
or what have you. Okay, so Mr. Dixon was against any recital of qualifications in the Constitution. Now, it doesn't matter what they were looking at and what they were discussing, because bottom line, was there any qualifications in the Constitution for a person in Congress, a person in the judiciary, or a person in the executive? Yeah, there are qualifications, as a matter of fact, for you to be a representative in the House of Representatives. A person has to be 25 years of age and a citizen for 7 years. To be in the Senate, you have to be 35. To be the president, you have to be 35. And you have to be a natural-born citizen. And with a senator, you only have to be a citizen for 10 years. I'd have to look it up. But there's you don't have to be a natural. The only position in all of the public offices that requires natural-born citizen is the executive. So, in other words, this is important because they were actually trying to show, you know, this importance and this credence of making sure that the people that were going to be involved in government were, you know, of good report. In other words, they were current on their debts and so forth. In other words, they had settled their accounts. And secondly, that they possessed land. In other words, they had stake in the game. Now,
so that would disqualify everyone nowadays because everyone owes money on their property.
Well, that's correct. And actually, when you think about it, when we vote and so forth, because it doesn't matter whether you have it. It's about whether you're paid in your account. Because I think that's what Mason was saying. He said that, you know, you either should have landed property or at least you should have a good account. In other words, if you're not paying, mm-hmm. if you haven't paid or what have you, that there's some interest or you owe some debt or fee or what have you. In other words, they were trying to create this, you know, this paradigm, or they were trying to ensure that the persons entering into public service were upholding to the full extent that was expected. And so they just wanted to make sure that they, you know, weren't not. I mean, how many people have we seen going into Obama's administration that didn't pay their taxes? So the intent was to ensure that everybody was, you know, diligent and forthright in keeping their accounts current and paid up. And so, because this, you know, things have changed a lot since then. But when you look at voting, the only people who could vote were property holders. Whether you owned the land or not, you had to hold property. So,
yeah.
You had to pay a tax, which was called a poll tax, to vote. That's how the state made its money on your property. There's a poll tax. Mm-hmm. And I think the poll tax was based upon either your size of land, or I don't know. It may be, in some cases, it may have been a flat rate. But I think what they wanted to do was, you know, go after, because this has always been the concept of governing, that the people that have invested more in land, they have greater holdings, assets, that they pay a little more than the other person. Right? You pay based on your assets. You pay based on your worth. You pay based on your risks and so forth. So anyway, Mr. Dixon was getting ready to go into the recital of the qualifications. And what I wanted to do is point out that all of this discussion was really kind of washed away for the most part. It didn't really take off, other than the fact that states were kind of left to maintaining their own standards. But can a state today create a standard to say you have to be a landholder to become a representative in the House of Representatives? The question asked is basically no. The answer to the question asked is actually no. because the states cannot create any additional barriers that the Constitution has. In other words, it's created the only barrier. You have to be 25 years of age, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be a citizen for 7 years. If the states, and the reason I went down this path, because every state in the union is violating the standards of a House of Representatives or person in Congress, period, whether they're in the House or whether they're in the Senate. And nobody even understands this. Because what does it take for your name to get on a ballot? The states have all created barriers to entry to basically say, oh, you have to be a party member to get your name on the ballot. When technically the states can't even do that. The standard is you have to be that age and you have to be, you know, a citizen for that long. If you meet those standards, then your name goes on the ballot.
Yeah.
Why are we allowing the party to control the parties, the Democrat and Republican parties? Why are we allowing them to control access to public office?
Yeah, good question.
There you go. That's why when you look at the color-coded Constitution, pointing out the violations, and people go, well, this is showing that these standards are being violated, but technically the violations aren't the age requirement and the, you know, the years of citizenship. It's additional standards that every state places upon every office. When it comes down to a court appointment, or when it comes down to an executive appointment, you know, are there any requirements? Now we look at the president, and there's all sorts of shenanigans. You have to get through a party primary. Hold it. Where in the Constitution does it say you have to complete through a primary process before you can actually be eligible to become president?
Yeah.
You see my point?
Yeah.
And so this is, you know, this is the honor of thieves, and most people in the Republican Party have no idea what they're doing and why this is even good. Because bottom line, if they're capable of down selecting and utilizing the party shenanigans to basically help trim down the list so that they can make sure whoever ultimately gets the position of a senator, who gets the position of president, is a person that's within their standards. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know if that makes sense, because when you really look at it, when we go through the Reagan campaign, Bush and Reagan were going at it, and Bush was the globalist choice. And it came down to this. When Reagan was going in, you probably don't know this story, but you can read about it. And when Reagan was getting ready to go into the convention to announce that Kemp was going to be his running mate, he was going to be, you know, his vice president, Henry Kissinger went in to have a seat with Ronald Reagan and basically said this: if you go through with nominating Kemp, we have, and I think he probably even showed him pictures of Kemp with, you know, compromising situations, and said, look, if you choose this guy, then we're going to expose him, you know, in the last minute, and we're going to make sure that Jimmy Carter becomes president. Again. Mm-hmm. So, therefore, you need to pick George H.W. Bush as your guy, which is exactly what ended up happening, instead of changing it up with somebody else. In other words, it didn't matter who Reagan was going to pick. It had to be Bush based on the globalists, because they wanted to make sure that Bush became the following president. because they want when it came down to Reagan. So here's the thing. Why is it that they didn't expose Reagan for, you know, anything or, you know, do these types of shenanigans? In other words, the globalists wanted to just make sure that George H.W. Bush was on that ticket to make it at least an acceptable position in moving forward into the next 4 years with Reagan and Bush instead of Carter and whomever. And so you see my point? Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. So as you know, as we look at that, and I you know, I scratch my head and go, why was that okay? Because most people look at Ronald Reagan as, you know, this firebrand. He was not owned by the globalists and so forth. And I'm going, I honestly think, because Ronald Reagan was the guy that put teeth in the equal employment opportunities and equal rights. In other words, he's the guy that kind of really started bolstering the EEO initiatives and so forth. Unlike John F. Kennedy, you know, there's some really good books out there that were written by Larry Elder and other black statesmen who are conservative, or, you know, I don't want to call them constitutional because there's very few people that are really constitutional. But Larry Elder was one that actually, you know, mocked, you know, all of the black people for having John F. Kennedy on their shelves, you know, pictures of him, you know, in their homes instead of Ronald Reagan, when Ronald Reagan was the guy that actually put teeth and made sure that, you know, equal rights were being protected. And most people don't know that. And as a matter of fact, Ronald Reagan was the guy that was convinced to actually provide amnesty for a whole bunch of illegals that were here, all unconstitutional. So in other words, Ronald Reagan wasn't this constitutional president. He was at least acceptable, and he was the portal to getting George H.W. Bush into office. And what's really interesting, and forgive me for going down this rat hole, but what's really interesting is George H.W. Bush was only to be president for 4 years. He was only to get into it, and then the next person would be truly a globalist puppet. And as a matter of fact, I don't know if you knew this, but George H.W. Bush considered Bill Clinton, William Jefferson Clinton, as much of his son as George W. Bush. In other words, really? He really looked at Clinton as, you know, as his own flesh and blood.
Wow.
And most people don't know. If you go back and you look at how hard he worked to make sure he didn't get reelected, you know, he really went out of his way. One of the things he did, because he didn't want to have, you know, this big campaign. We just won this war. 1992, we just won this war. And most people believe that he lost that election because it's about the economy, stupid. Remember, I don't know if you are old enough for that campaign time, but Bill Clinton kept on going, it's about the economy, stupid. And they were trying to hold George H.W. Bush to the fact that he raised taxes, that, you know, he promised he wouldn't, and he went back on his promise. I mean, when we look at what he did and how hard he was trying not to be president. So his only true effort in campaigning, we're going into a break here. So if you just kind of hold on, folks, we'll be back in the field. And so we'll get back into this little storytelling of what happened during the 1992 Bush re-election campaign, and how Clinton was basically the guy that crossed the finish line, not with honors, but with actually shame. And so you just have to scratch your head. We'll be right back in Scratching That Head.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so welcome back. And the point is this, is that when Clinton was running, he was out there fighting for his life. And all sorts of things were coming out, like his marijuana passed, you know, his Rhodes Scholar program. Now, most people look at the Rhodes Scholar as this, you know, wow, this guy's really intelligent and you know, wow, he's international. The reality is the Rhodes Scholar Program is a program that the globalists use to get people into their fold and to doing, you know, becoming a part of their machine. And so as we look at the campaign of 1992, George H.W. Bush's only efforts to actually get reelected was to get on a train and go through a few states as he waved to people as he passed by and spoke at different little stops along the way. And for the most part, it was really milquetoast campaigning, if you understand what I'm saying. Does that make sense? You get it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you know, were you aware of what happened and how that went down?
No, I wasn't.
He basically ignored the rest of the United States, only went through the Midwest with this train, and he was still winning significantly. So they had to get somebody else to split the votes. In other words, this was 1906 all over again. In looking at Taft getting reelected when they wanted and they needed, and actually Teddy Roosevelt wanted to ensure that a real progressive took over the office because Taft was not getting the job done. He was not furthering the progressive agenda. So Teddy Roosevelt put his name in to run against him, Taft, and Wilson. Or, you know, Roosevelt, Taft, and Wilson were the three. Interestingly enough, mm-hmm. He ran independent, so he would go all the way to the end to ensure that it wasn't a beauty contest between two. They did the exact same thing with Ross Perot. Are you old enough to remember Ross Perot?
I am. I remember him.
Okay, great.
I don't remember how old I was, but I do remember him.
Okay. So Ross Perot was out there, and he was doing a great job in presenting and going through the details. He proved himself a formidable statesman. You know, he was a fast-talking Texan and was able to just, you know, his breadth of knowledge on the issues and so forth was so impressive that everybody was kind of wondering, shoot, he may actually beat out Clinton. Anyway, what ended up happening was Ross Perot and George H.W. Bush took about 61% of the vote between the two of them, between the independent and the Republican, which means that Clinton won the election with 39% of the popular vote.
Hmm.
Huh. So because
it, right.
So because it went down that way, because he was the, you know, the guy that got the highest amount of votes. And so I think Bush was like 20-some percent and Perot was in the teens. And so, you know, Bush and, you know, actually Clinton and Gore took office. And as soon as they took office, there was this big deal about NAFTA. Now, at this point in time, Congress was solid Democrat. In other words, both houses were Democrat. And at this point in time, in 1991, George H.W. Bush brought to America Agenda 21. And he brought to America these laws and governing plans that would basically surrender or put us on a track where we would be surrendering our rights, our properties, and all of these types of things that needed to be implemented. And so the only way that could happen is to get it through with this international trade deal called NAFTA in Congress. And there was just no way a Republican president would be able to pass or get Congress to pass a bill that would pass this trade agreement for NAFTA. In other words, by using the treaty, because, you know, everybody has been bamboozled for over a century, almost two centuries, that people have been bamboozled over this concept that if it's a treaty, it becomes the supreme law of the land. This is why we go through the ratification debates, and this is why I go through the painstaking details of, you know, how when you read the Supremacy Clause and you start understanding the hard limitations that are actually within the Constitution, then you realize that the Supremacy Clause says that all laws that are pursuant to this Constitution and treaties that are passed, that are made with the authority of the United States. In other words, if they make a treaty, it becomes the supreme law of the land. Only and only if it is within those enumerated objects. In other words, when we kind of look at this concept of enumerated, or let me kind of back up. When we look at the limitations, the jurisdiction and limitations of this, of the United States in making treaties, they cannot make a treaty regarding a matter that is not enumerated in Article 1, Section 8. In other words, for them to be able to adjoin to the UN, there would need to be a power delegated in Article 1, Section 8 that says Congress shall have the power to adjoin to international entities, international polities, to basically submit the Union and the states to international law, because that's what that treaty did. And right. They don't have that authority to adjoin to a foreign entity and actually make those laws, you know, enforceable within the United States. Nor did they have, we already went through the immigration, right? I went through the painstaking detail. The federal government has no authority over immigration. And they passed a treaty with the UN regarding refugees, which is the importation of people. It's not even immigration. It's literally the importation of people. And so in the 1950s, the federal government passed, I think it's 50 or 60s, they passed in the Senate a treaty that allowed the United States to participate in the UN program of refugee resettlement by taking refugees from, you know, impoverished areas or inflicted, you know, bad areas of the world and bring them into the United States. That is literally the same as the importation of people. And when we read, there's no delegation at all for immigration or importation. their only power is the naturalization. So going down this path of refugees coming into the United States, there it is not an enumerated power, and they basically bamboozled people because they made a treaty that they had no authority to make, and then they just said, well, this is the supreme law of the land, and we've just bought into these things. So this is how, when we look at the 1992 election, Bush knew that he couldn't get this globalist plan of NAFTA and the Agenda 21 through Congress to actually pass this bill and then to pass this treaty. So he had to step down because there was just no way there was they didn't see a plausible way in the next 2 years of having a Republican president and shifting the control of Congress over to the Republicans. The only way that would happen, and usually it's a two-year cycle, it happened with Trump. When we look at a Democratic president, it takes 2 years before it flips, but nine times out of 10, the opposing party. So I'm going to tell you, in 2026, there's a great likelihood that Congress will flip Democrat, even though right now it is marginal Republican on both sides. Marginal. It'll flip Democrat because everybody perceives that that's how you keep the president in check, by the parties, keeping the parties divided. And so that's exactly what happened, because it was Newt Gingrich and the Republicans literally took over the Congress in 1994 with the Contract for America and all of these other things, because America was really concerned about this new liberal president who was passing laws like the Motor Voter Act, basically getting illegals to be able to get registered to vote. That's exactly what the Motor Voter Act did. Anyway, so Clinton came in, and the reason I'm bringing this up is because of this other part about Ross Perot. There was this huge panic by the American people that, hold on here, this is a bad treaty. This NAFTA deal and this treaty that you're going to ram down our throats, that is not good for America. And all of a sudden, Ross Perot started piping up with this rhetoric about how that this is bad, and he's going to debate Gore. And he's going to actually, prove to the American people why this treaty and this deal that, they're trying to get Congress to do is the worst thing for America, even though it's the best thing for Perot and his businesses, because he was a very rich businessman. And it's exactly what he needed, because he was the one that was going to benefit. As a matter of fact, a huge transshipment point in Texas was going to be under his control if this all happened. So anyway, there was this huge televised debate between Al Gore and Perot. And if anybody understands the mental capacity of Al Gore, it's not very high. Al Gore,
I remember watching that debate.
Okay, there you go. And so Al Gore, remember, he actually did a movie where he told us that the earth has a fever. Hey, give this guy the latitude without a script. He can really wander. And when you watch that debate between Al Gore and Ross Perot was completely out of character. All of a sudden, he couldn't find the right words, and he was struggling. And everybody goes, wow, Al Gore beat him. And it seemed like it was going to happen. There was nothing we could stop it, and they still couldn't pull it off. So when you go and you look at the history, folks, of when NAFTA passed, it had to pass in the middle of the night, where there was real arm twisting and real threats actually being, sent into very specific people that they needed to get across the finish line to get this thing done. And it was basically down to the wire. the globalist agenda was hanging by a thread in America. And with all of the money and everything and all the efforts, they were able to get it across the wire. Now, the fact of the matter is all of these things are all unconstitutional. They don't have the authority to do these things, to create that treaty and to imply these powers or to even assume these powers. And yet, because Congress and the parties, you know, got it across the finish line, we, as the, you know, as the good, fair-natured people that we are with the big yellow smiley face, we stand up and applaud. Well, it was all done with fair politics. Okay, yay, yay team, whatever. It's just so infuriating that we actually allow them to just steamroll over us. But anyway, I digress. The whole point was that Perot ended up coming back because Dole was going to win. Nobody understands this. Why did Perot have to enter into the next election? Because Clinton barely won with 41 or 42% of the popular vote in the second election. And everybody thought he was the most popular president of the United States. When not once did he ever have an election in those two presidential runs where he even garnered 50% of the vote. How is it that they've twisted the truth so badly to everybody just accepts? It's kind of like I saw this piece of information, meme, what have you, on social media, where they take the survey of asking how many people, how many blacks in America do you think there are? What's the percentage? And most people were saying about 40%, when I think the reality was it's less than 20%. And based on commercials and everything else, you'd think, wow, it's more like 60% or what have you. But anyway, the reality is, you know, we have all been manipulated in seeing and perceiving America and things in these eyes that they want us to see these things so that we don't. It's just like homosexuality. It's like all of these different things. Most people would think, oh, well, these numbers are really high. No, the numbers weren't really high, and the only way they were actually able to increase numbers is through the manipulation and lies. It's the same thing with interracial marriages. Most people would think interracial marriages, I think the poll had it at about 20%, and it's like 1%. So you looked at these numbers, and you go, wow, I mean, you know, I actually was thinking wrong, too, because we base everything on how we see things, commercials, television, and those types of things. And we actually think that the numbers are like transgenders. You know, there's got to be 5-6% of transgenders. I think the poll actually had it like 10%, and it's less than a percent. Anyway. As we see things, we're not seeing what the real truth is. And when it comes to politics, it is a kabuki theater. I mean, It's all designed to get you to believe what they need you to believe. Anyway, so let's get back to, you know, this dialogue. And Mr. Dixon was starting to talk because I started going down this path of talking about how they were, you know, here they're debating issues that never actually stuck to the wall. Remember these ideas that, you know, get thrown at the wall and they kind of slide down, and over time that people just lose interest because it's just not that good of an idea. It just won't stick. And so anyway, so let's get to Mr. Dixon here.
Mr. Dixon was against any recital of qualifications in the Constitution. It was impossible to make a complete one, and a partial one would by implication tie up the hands of the legislature from supplying the omission. The best defense lay in the freeholders who were to elect the legislature. While this source should remain pure, the public interest would be safe. If it ever should be corrupt, no little expedience would repel the danger. He doubted the policy of interweaving into a Republican constitution a veneration for wealth. he had always understood that a veneration for poverty and virtue were the objects of Republican encouragement. It seemed improper that any man of merit should be subjected to disability in a republic where merit was understood to form the great title to public trust, honors, and rewards.
And now it's actually different, is it? I mean, it's not about honor and virtue, right? It's not merit for people to get into office. It's about, it's about quotas.
Mm-hmm.
Our first black president. We still have to have a woman president.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So they were talking about how important it was to actually maintain this concept of merit, you know, and ensuring that the people that really deserve it. When you look at Bill Clinton going and becoming a Rhodes Scholar, he probably deserved it because of his intelligence, but he didn't deserve getting involved at any way at all in politics because he was completely owned by the globalists. I mean, it's only obvious that, you know, they protected his philandering and all of his bad behavior because as long as he could have his bad behavior, then they could, you know, control him and he would do exactly what they wanted him to do.
Right.
Okay. So Mr. Gary of Massachusetts then said,
if property be one object of government, provisions for securing it cannot be improper.
Then Mr. Madison basically piped up about land. This is really good stuff here. Go ahead.
So Mr. Madison moved to strike out the word landed before the word qualification. But the proposition should be agreed to, he wished the committee to be at liberty to report the best criterion they could devise. Landed possessions were no certain evidence of real wealth. Many enjoyed them to a great extent who were more in debt than they were worth. The unjust laws of the states had proceeded more from this class of men than any others. It had often happened that men who had acquired landed property on credit got into the legislatures with a view of promoting an unjust protection against their creditors. In the next place, if a small quantity of land should be made the standard, it would be no security if a large one, it would exclude the proper representatives of those classes of citizens who were not landholders. It was politic as well as just that the interests and rights of every class should be duly represented and understood in the public councils. It was a provision everywhere established that the country should be divided into districts and representatives taken from each in order that the legislative assembly might equally understand and sympathize with the rights of the people of every part of the community. It was not less proper that every class of citizens should have an opportunity of making their rights be felt and understood in the public councils. Hold on, I just lost my place. It was
the three principles.
Provision.
No, the three principles.
Really?
Yeah. So what you read was it was not less proper that every class of citizens should have an opportunity of making their rights and be felt and understood in the public councils. The three principal classes, that's where you are now. The three principal classes.
Three principal classes into which our citizens were divisible were the landed, the commercial, and the manufacturing. The second and third class bear as yet a small proportion to the first. The proportion, however, will daily increase. We see in the populous countries in Europe now what we shall be hereafter. These classes understand much less of each other's interests and affairs than men of the same class inhabiting different districts. It is particularly requisite, therefore, that the interests of one or two of them should not be left entirely to the care of the impartiality of the third. This must be the case if landed qualification should be required. Few of the mercantile and scarcely any of the manufacturing class choosing wealth to continue in business to turn any part of their stock into landed property. Mm-hmm. For these reasons, he wished if it were possible that some of the criterion that the mere possession of land should be devised. He concurred with Mr. Governor Morris in thinking that qualifications in the elector would be much more effectual than in the elected. If the former would discriminate between real and ostensible property in the latter, that he was aware of the difficulty of forming any uniform standard that would suit the different circumstances and opinions prevailing in the different states.
Okay, so did it make sense with what you read, other than losing your place maybe here or there? But did what you read, what he just said, did that make sense? Because what he said is they were going down this path of basically creating this landed person be the only type of person that could be a public servant. Madison pointed out that things are changing. A landed person is agrarian because they own a lot of land, and what they're doing is they're producing the food, the livestock, what have you, for, you know, for the community. In contrast, there is the mercantile as well as the factories, right? The because he pointed out the differences of the three. There was the manufacturing class as well as the mercantile class and as well as the agrarian class. And technically, we now have a technical class, right? In other mm-hmm. words, we now have a sciences where engineering is being applied not just in the manufacturing of goods or the creation of services and goods, where it's actually getting into biological engineering, computer engineering, and those types of things. So our world has only expanded as technology in all of these different various fields, these various disciplines have continued to expand. And at the very beginning in this Constitutional Convention, the paradigm was laid out that the only ruling people, those people of the class, as Madison's talking about, would be agrarian.
Right.
And so where would America be? And as a matter of fact, this came down to, ultimately, and we're almost out of time, so we'll kind of, I'll just cut it off with this. Hamilton and Jefferson got into a big debate, and it wasn't a, you know, just a quick debate of 5 minutes or a day. This took a long time going back and forth. But Jefferson believed that America would be better if it maintained its focus on agrarian matters, because that's where, you know, they were, you know, one, slavery was very prominent in that, but it was also this concept of being closer to God. And Hamilton felt that America needed to go down this path of manufacturing and go down this path of textiles and so forth, that we needed to compete in all things, not just in the agrarian market space. And so this went on a long time. And I have to say, Hamilton was right, because maintaining competitiveness in all markets is critical. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.